Welcome to the Golf Legends Podcast, where we cover the champions and major winners of golf. Your hosts and main contributors are Dustin and Chad. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, everybody, we're back with the Golf Legends Podcast. I'm Chad, and I'm here with Dustin.
How's it going? It's an interesting couple of days we had with this weather and how, God, I need it to be springtime.
We need to get out there and play some golf again. These long, dreary winter days are wearing on.
Yes.
But we do have something big to cover today. We're covering something pretty exciting.
I would say we're gonna hit the Trinity. If I had to think of anything, it's we're gonna cover Ben Hogan today.
Heavy hitter.
Yeah.
Literally and figuratively a heavy hitter.
Yeah, for being such a small in stature, Ben Hogan, man.
That's awfully spoken.
He changing the game isn't correct. Let's say he perfected the game. That would be, I would say, the easiest way to sum up what Ben Hogan did for the sport of golf is he perfected this game. And you know what? Frankly, he's of the Trinity, I would say, if you consider Byron Nelson, Sam Snead, and Ben Hogan, he's the working man. He's the everyman. And you'll kind of learn this, he's the guy who won more tournament. I'm sorry, not two more tournaments than Sam Snead, but one more
majors.
Thank you, majors than Sam Snead and Byron Nelson. Where Byron was that comet style amazingness, and Sam Snead was consistent. Ben Hogan's life got in his way, I would say, and yet he persevered and powered on. I mean, really more than anything else. So
and he's of all the golfers that were born around the turn of 1900,
yeah,
he's probably the most recognizable name.
Absolutely.
And it's because he was consistent. He played golf for a very long time, but he was also very successful for a very long time.
And he
left a major mark on golf.
More than everything, almost anyone. I mean, you can look at Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus and things like that, and they will constantly quote him. They'll constantly talk about him. So this could be a little bit of a longer episode. Chad and I might actually split it up in two. It depends. But I'm going to go right off the bat. He created a book. I believe it's called The Fundamentals of Golf or The Fundamentals of the Swing. I own the book. It's an amazing book. If you are an amateur golfer that just wants to be better at golf, read it. Learn from it. We're not going to cover it in this episode as best
too much
we can.
Material.
Yeah, it's an amazing book. We will absolutely do a separate episode on it. But it's just so much information that I think it would do his legend a little injustice. It wouldn't be the best thing for us to do. So to start the episode, Ben Hogan was born in August 13th, 1912. He died July 25th, 1997. He has 69 tour wins, PGA Tour wins, and he has 9 major tournament championships. He's right behind Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, and Walter Hagen. Walter Hagen has 11. He was in the company originally as the only people that won the Grand Slam, so to speak, which is the 4 major tournaments. It was originally Jack Nicklaus, him, and Gene Sarazen, and then obviously Tiger Woods jumped into that mix. So he, like I said, 9 majors. He is. Chad was right. He is a heavy hitter in the sense of beyond all-time great. He's we're gonna get into his life shortly. The most bizarre thing I would say of all this is he has a truly tragic life on some points, and he was able to turn it around. I mean, or at least beat it into submission or something.
Yeah,
I mean,
several like really, really tragic events, you know, happened to him, if you want to put it that way, or occur in
happened
his life.
Around him. Yeah.
Happened
definitely
close by
affecting
or near to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he's able to come back from all of them. You know, it's some it took longer than others, but he just persevered and pushed on and just had a really strong work ethic towards practicing golf. And it, you know, from retooling his swing to, you know, recovering from different things, he made it back and he left a really impressive legacy behind.
Yeah. And so I actually misspoke. The four that have won the full Grand Slam is Nicholas, Woods, Player, Gene Sarazen, and then obviously Ben Hogan, who we're covering now. So he was born in Stevensville, Texas. He was the third and the youngest child of Chester and Clara Williams. His father was a blacksmith. He lived about 10 miles southwest of in Dublin until 1921, and then they moved basically to Fort Worth. When Hogan was 9 years old, in 1922, his father committed suicide he shot himself. If you have a second, and I didn't put this in any of our notes, there is a brilliant article, I believe, on ESPN. Just look it up. It's called, like, The Tragedy of Ben Hogan or something, and it talks about, through other golfers' eyes, not only who he was, but how tragedy shaped him. And his father dying was always with him. I mean, it became something, and his father died in front of him. So it became something that was ingrained in his personality. He was an introvert much into his later years, and I mean, obviously. So the kid Ben Hogan is not having the greatest beginning of his childhood, we'll say.
Yeah, yeah. They say that the suicide really kind of shaped his introverted nature, and. Obviously, you know, I've never been through anything like that, but I can't even imagine, you know, what kind of toll that takes on a kid.
Yeah, I mean, so and it was hard times, right? We're in 1920s, like we're legit in the Great Depression. I mean, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and they're in the South. They're in the Dust Bowl.
Yeah, this is not going well.
Yeah, things are not going well. The family. After the father's suicide, they had some major financial difficulties because he was the main breadwinner. So the children ended up needing to take jobs.
Yeah.
His older brother, Royal, had to quit school at the age of 14. Ben sold newspapers. His mom was a seamstress.
Yeah, so they're doing everything. I mean, look, they're hustling. They're doing everything they can to get by, to day-to-day, I mean, whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, and what kind of got Ben initially into golf was a tip from a friend that led to him getting a caddying job at the Glen Garden Country Club at 11.
So, yeah, we're getting that once again. I mean, we kind of keep going into the greats of golf start very young.
Yeah, if you have kids that you want to be like championship golfers,
yeah.
Introduce get them to a caddying job as early as legally possible, and they're probably going to become, you know, if they stick with it, they're going to be a good golfer on some level. So yeah, the Glen Garden Country Club was a little bit south of where they were living. It was a 9-hole course. One of the fellow caddies was a guy that you may have heard of. His name's Byron Nelson.
Byron.
Obviously, we covered him in previous episodes.
It was our first episode. It feels so long ago, but yes, yeah. they would, I guess, sounds like constantly play, right? I mean,
yeah, they became kind of you know, two good golfers that had a little bit of friendly competition between themselves, played in a lot of young tournaments growing up at the country club there, you know, all through their teenage years while they were finishing school, and had a lot of, you know, dramatic tournaments where they tied.
Man,
and
I mean,
they went into sudden death holes.
How do you not get better, right? Like you, I mean, it's as if, like, your playing partner is a professional golfer. I mean, they're playing, and they're the ones winning, right? Like, these two kids, these two 15-year-olds are going after each other, and they're the junior winners, basically.
Really, they probably, if we were able to talk to them today, which we're obviously not, they'd probably both give each other credit towards some of their success, or at least their hunger for getting better, because generally when people make it to elite levels in sports, they have somebody who they were playing against as a kid, whether it was an older sibling.
Yes, pushing them, you know, teaching them.
Somebody who
them,
was
yes,
more physically yes, gifted absolutely. Or talented, or somebody who was equivalent to them that kept them going.
Yeah, so they play this Christmas caddy tournament where they both tie, and then Byron Nelson actually comes up and basically wins it in a sudden death 9-hole, you know, wins it by a stroke. Nelson gets granted this junior membership, and it says, you know, like course rules, club rules don't allow caddies 16 or older. So basically this Love South Texas golf clubs, I guess, they don't allow adults to caddy, it looks like.
Yeah,
so,
I guess.
So Hogan took his game to little daily courses, you know, Katy Lakes, Worth Hills, and Zeebo's. At that same time, right around, I mean, he's 16, so about a year later, he drops out of high school, and he turns pro. Basically 6 months before he was 18 at the Texas Open in San Antonio. It's 1930 at this point. And I'm pretty sure he's about to meet his wife. Is that right?
Yeah. Her name's Valerie Fox.
Yep.
He meets her, in Fort Worth in the mid 1920s, initially, and then they get reacquainted in 1932, when he landed a low paying, club pro job in, Cleburne, I believe that's pronounced.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Where her family had moved. And, 3 years later, in 1935, they get married at her parents' home.
That should seem, if we kind of harken back to, I don't think Sam Snead did. He might be the only one, but Byron Nelson definitely did. They're not making money. I mean, like, nothing to get, like, even if they're winning tournaments, even if they're winning these things, they're not making a bunch of money to be going around and playing other tournaments. I mean, he takes this low-paying job basically as a club pro here. To survive. No.
Yeah, I mean,
right? Because
this is all through the Depression. And
yeah.
This is like the Central Texas, you know, it's the Dust Bowl. There's not a lot of money floating around, so they're just kind of scraping by.
Well, yeah, so he, and unlike Nelson, because he's that wonderful comment, and Snead is a little bit around this time as well. I mean, Hogan's struggling. I mean, Hogan turned pro in 1930 and didn't win a tournament, one of his first tournaments, until 1940. So he's going around and, like, playing golf, being the club pro. I mean, he's doing everything he can to get better and win, but he's not winning. I mean, he's not, you know.
It took him 10 years,
yeah,
and when won the first one, he won 3 in a row.
Yeah.
So he
hit onto something.
He hit
obviously.
A stride. Yeah, that was he won the 3 consecutive tournaments in North Carolina in March of 1940 was when that first one came along, and his wife Valerie was an avid supporter of him. They had a great relationship, and that was something that kept him going because, like Dustin just said, his early years as a pro,
man.
You know. 10 years as a pro, and you haven't won anything, and you're really scraping by.
I mean, because you're not making.
Nowadays, that doesn't happen.
No. Because if you're in, I mean, you're on the PGA Tour. I mean, if you're on the what's the secondary tour? Why can't I remember it? Anyway, if you're on like the second, not the PGA Tour, I mean, you make a cut into the weekend, and you get anywhere there. I mean, you're getting like $50,000 to the purse of $1.5 million. I mean, like you're making. You're making a living,
yeah.
Like you're able to support yourself here, and in those times, besides playing exhibitions, which Ben Hogan wasn't doing then because he wasn't any good. I mean, like
yeah.
I hate to say that it's not that.
Yeah.
I mean, but he wasn't winning tournaments, so he wasn't making a name for himself. So I mean,
yeah.
Like it's all those things, right? He was a professional golfer, which is great. But he wasn't any, like, draw.
Well, yeah,
you know?
He went broke more than once while he was a professional golfer.
I
so
mean, yeah, we're
between
talking
that
Ben
1930.
Hogan here. Like, Ben
yeah.
Hogan, the I mean, that's the crazy part of this.
Well, and golf was, you know, it was nothing like it
no,
is today. It was still
yeah.
in its infancy as a professional sport. So
yes.
They were still trying to monetize a lot of things. And like you said, we're just after the Depression. So the country's economy still recovering at this point.
Yeah, so he His wife is feeling good about him, telling him to keep going through. He's battling a hook. You'll see something in Ben Hogan's career that is interesting. Because he was so specific about swing technique and swing like technology, basically, his life is very much scrutinized by the way he hit the golf ball. And so when we have early on, he battles a hook. At one point, he's having issues putting. Like, it is, we see Ben Hogan's life as a golfer, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Really scrutinizing every point, and we'll get to a little bit later, but that's why it's funny, where it's like, oh, he's battling a hook that he later cured. Well, of course he later cured. He's Ben Hogan.
And we'll get to it a little bit later, but Ben Hogan, if there's one thing to remember about Ben Hogan, is he's the greatest ball striker
ever.
This day, and probably that ever will be, because there's a lot of technological things that can cure things, whereas he cured it by
practice. Yeah. Like the cute hook the cute fade, the starting left, drawing right, that's Ben Hogan's. You're welcome. You know, like if you were able to do it, he's the one that taught you that, right? Whether you know it or not.
He learned that actually putting a little bit of bend on the ball is easier to do than focusing on hitting it straight.
Yes. So he I believe it's 1938. 1938, he finishes 13th. Welcome to 1938. Thank goodness we're not there anymore, because he still has to take an assistant pro job. This time he takes an assistant pro job at Century Country Club in Purchase, New York. And he works there until he's the head pro at 1941. And then he goes to another one, Hershey Country Club in Hershey, Pennsylvania, in 1938. So kind of the prime of his life, right? I mean, how old is he here? He's 20 something.
In 1941, at that point, he's 29.
Okay. 29. Yeah. So, I mean, he's, you're coming into your age here. You're coming into like you're hopefully out of your wild 20s, so to speak. And you're understanding how the body moves and works, and he still has a job as a head pro. I mean, he's still doing everything he can to make sure he makes money.
Yeah, and his Hogan's prime years are considered 1938 to 1959. So even though he didn't win a professional tournament until 1940, he was really starting to catch his stride in 1938. He's going on the uptick,
basically.
You know, he was still making money, and he was getting better on the money list, higher up on the money list. So he was still finishing well. He just didn't actually get that first tour victory until 1940.
And then, so the funny thing is that we'll cover this very quickly, and then we're about to get in depth in a not so fun topic. But 1943, he is in the United States Air Force until 1945. He was stationed in Fort Worth, Texas, so he didn't actually see any duty. He became a utility pilot with the rank of lieutenant, but still, he's in the war. I mean, right? He's still there, like
able-bodied male.
And he's like Chad said, he was 29. He's 32 here, right? I mean, and I think that needs to be in perspective. He's on that upswing, like Chad just talked about.
This is prime.
And now he has to take a couple of steps back. I mean, you're in the war. I mean, it's different, right? It is what it is, kind of thing. And it's sad to say, but that's what happens.
So he was in the war, World War II, from 1943 to 1945. And in February of 1949...
To cover this, there's not a lot of time, there's not a lot of, like, Ben Hogan's stats are very limited from when he enters the war, basically, into this, what Chad's going to bring up. I'm sure he's winning some tournaments, I'm sure he's obviously a club pro, he's doing things.
Yes, so we'll get into the first major tragedy, other than obviously his father's suicide that he experienced at a very young age. But he and his wife are driving, and have a head-on collision with a Greyhound bus on a really foggy bridge early in the morning in Texas. That's in February 2nd, 1949. And Hogan actually reacted right before the accident, and he threw himself across the front seat in hopes of shielding his wife. And luckily that he did that, he actually saved his own life because the steering column of the vehicle that they were in was shoved through the front seat. So he most certainly would have been killed.
So true tragedy. Yeah. I mean, absolutely, it could have obviously been much worse. I mean...
In a head-on collision with a bus.
And you're talking a bus in 1949. Yeah, like, this is just a steel...
Yeah,
like,
just a complete steel.
Wow.
And did a lot of damage. And there's no airbags, obviously, in 1949.
Yeah.
So this accident left Hogan at age 36. Double fracture of the pelvis, fractured collarbone, fractured ankle, chipped rib, near-fatal blood clots... he suffered lifelong circulation problems and other physical limitations because of this accident. The doctors were not confident that he would ever actually walk again. And while Hogan was in the hospital, his life was endangered by a blood clot problem that led doctors to tie off his vena cava, which is one of the major valves of the heart.
Jeez.
Hogan left the hospital on April 1st, which was 59 days after the accident.
That's
so he was in the hospital for 2 months.
Yeah, how are you surviving? Like, and you're in 1949. Let's not forget this. Like, right? Like, this is not the greatest time for medicine. I mean, right? Like, this is not where we are today. This is a car crash that probably should have taken his life. And to backtrack just very minutely. When Chad was saying, yes, he's winning, so he actually gets the Vardon Trophy, 1940-1941. He's the leading money winner, 40-41-42, and he won his first tournament. I'm sorry, won his first championship in 1946, the PGA Championship, and then two in 1948, the U.S. Open, and then the PGA Championship again. So he is an established golfer at this point. He is not one of the greats.
But three majors, you're one of the greats at this point.
And leading the money list so much so. This tragedy happens. I mean, and it is 59 days in the hospital, everything Chad just said. He somehow wants to golf still. I mean, you just had this. His wife luckily only had like minor injuries and scratches. Thank God to Ben Hogan. I mean, right? Like for doing this.
But I mean, 37 years old, he's coming off this tragic, you know, life-altering accident where his whole body was beat up. A lot of people would have just hung him up.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, that's crazy talk, right? I mean, that's the thing. So we can get we're gonna get so he comes back. I mean, I don't know what else to say, right?
You know, like, he left the hospital on April 1st of 49, and he resumed his golf activities November of 1949.
Yeah, so
he wasn't playing professional golf again at that point. He didn't play the rest of the 49 season. He returned to the PGA to start the 1950 season at the Los Angeles Open.
Yes, which is where he ties Sam Snead, his good old buddy Sam Snead, over 72 holes and loses in an 18-hole playoff. But we're about to get to a very important part of his career. But in his career, so it's 1950, he wins the U.S. Open. He wins the U.S. Open in 1951, so he goes back-to-back. He's the PGA Player of the Year those same years as well. So he has this life-altering, insane accident where he shouldn't be doing much. And he comes back to win these major tournaments. I mean, this is a... Like, tenacity isn't the right word for this. It's not the same as, you know, 9 months later after his, after, I mean, basically after his this accident, he's starting to walk around, and then he plays a tournament in 1950 that he ties the one of the greatest players of all time. Yeah. I mean,
and he essentially has as many accolades and major victories after the accident as he did before the accident.
So, yes.
You know, it was obviously a major hiccup or road bump in the road, if you will, but he took some time and he got back to the level that he was at. And
so, yeah, so we're going to enter the 1953 season, which is there's not a lot of golfers who have seasons. Byron Nelson had one. I know Tiger Woods, the 2000 season. And then Ben Hogan's 1953 season. And this is nothing short of amazing. So it's 4 years after this crash. He is obviously winning tournaments. He's obviously winning majors. He is a force in golf again. It is hard for him to walk in general. Like, it's hard for him to play more than 18 holes a day. And so, I mean, he has lifelong injuries. I mean, he has lifelong things he's dealing with. So he goes to Carnoustie and he wins that championship. He wins the Open. He enters six tournaments. He wins five of them. I mean, it's among those in 1953, it was the Masters, the U.S. Open, the Open Championship. He went in that succession: Masters, U.S. Open, Open. Like, what are you talking about here? He won all the majors that year, and because he didn't enter the PGA Championship, right?
I mean, because the PGA Championship, which is, this just sounds asinine to think about now, but for some reason the PGA Championship and the British Open overlapped. The tournaments were going on at the same time, so you had to pick one or the other.
Well, you knew, which, I mean, obviously, you got, you got to know that's just a stupid play.
That's just, you know, the PGA
wanting to flex a little bit.
Flexing against, you know, global golf or vice versa, whatever it might be. Because obviously now the four tournaments are the PGA, the U.S. Open, the Masters, and the Open Championship.
That's right,
And they're all spaced out equally so that all the best players, because you want the best players playing in your tournament. You don't want to have them pick between two different tournaments. We all know that when we're watching golf on TV, when there's two different tournaments going on and you're splitting all the big names between them. It makes no sense.
So he declined to play that PGA Championship, but the only other golfer to do it in that succession is Tiger Woods. And that definitely says something. The crazier part of all this is 1953. Ben Hogan has had a very good amount of tragedy and interruption, we'll say, in his life. He's 40 years old when he does this.
That's unbelievable.
And let that sink in for just a second. A 40-year-old. And, you see the kid, we can call them kids, right? 23, 24, 25, 18. They're great players. Great players. Winning majors now. A 40-year-old went out and won back-to-back-to-back major championships in a year.
And potentially could have won the fourth if it was not a scheduling conflict.
I mean,
so we don't even know. We'll never know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a wow.
I mean, Tiger Woods just turned 40, a year or two ago?
Yeah.
And they were talking about how his career's over and all this sort of garbage. And these guys regularly were winning all the biggest tournaments well into their 40s.
Yeah. I mean,
obviously the game's evolved some, and it's a young man's game now. But
So 1953 is a true watershed moment in golf and in his life, in his winnings. He skips the PGA because, number one, like Chad was saying, there's this huge scheduling conflict. If you know anything about Ben Hogan was meticulous about preparation and about
strategy.
Yes, thank you. And he was a golfer that shot a number, right? He saw par, he went, I'm shooting 70, or whatever it was, right? He doesn't like match play because match play is against an opponent, and it's not, I mean, yes, it's against the course, but it's more against an opponent. It's beating someone. He wants to beat the course. He wants to know the ins and outs of the course.
And he doesn't care about the people that he's playing. He's playing against himself, yes, against the course.
Very much.
And the weather and whatever else might be there. So, yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing, whereas we talk about, you know, Gene Sarazen, where he was just a ferocious competitor.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah,
he wanted to
beat
people.
Yes.
And he loved the competition, yes, of everyone on the course, whereas this is kind of the polar opposite of that, where Hogan was introverted. He didn't care about the people as much as he did his preparation and what he could do to affect his chances of winning against the course.
Yeah, so, I mean, and he's – I love Ben Hogan. I mean – The introvertness, I can understand. I mean, I can get, especially with how young a tragedy he how young he was when that happened, and then obviously with his car crash. But you know, he plays Marion, the U.S. Open in Marion, and doesn't have a 7-iron in the bag, and he's asked, obviously, why don't you have this in your bag? And he says, "There's no 7-iron shots in Marion." I mean, that's the level of confidence. And how much he knows he has in his ability.
Game.
Yes, his game. But yet he knows the course, right? He knows he's not going to be in a position, whatever his 7-iron could hit, that he doesn't need it. I mean, that's the comedy of all this. And it's just hilarious. So he's widely acknowledged as one of the greatest ball strikers who ever played this game, ever. And we're going to get into a little bit of why now. So Hogan is credited, and you can hear Tiger. We'll have some quotes from Tiger Woods, from Jack Nicklaus in here. He's really credited into inventing practicing golf, and not going out and just hitting balls. That was a big thing too. But like, you were hitting balls for a reason. You were taking this on and practicing. And not just being out there.
But, yeah, practicing with a purpose.
Yes.
You know, shooting at targets. And a lot of the methodical things that, you know, Tiger Woods is famous for. Well, he'll take an 8-iron out there and he wants to just – he's working on shaping shots a certain way.
Yeah.
And he's just going to hit until he can shape a shot around a tree the way that he wants to, or whatever it might be. But that's the type of practice that we're talking about with Hogan.
Yeah, and so like one of his quotes is, "You hear stories about me beating my brains out practicing, but I was enjoying myself. I couldn't wait to get up in the morning so I could hit balls. When I'm hitting balls where I want, hard and crisply, it's a joy that very few people experience." It's 100% true if you like golf. I mean, you take a bucket of balls, right? Maybe you hit 10 pure, right? That's the new thing. Like, right, we're hitting them pure. But when you hit it pure and it goes where you want and what you designed, it might be the greatest feeling ever. You're going to hit 20 others that kind of do that.
Yeah.
But it's that pure shot. And that's what Ben Hogan was famous for, was making sure he understood how to match his clubs to the yardages, to the reference points on all the courses and trees and bunkers. And that's how he improved his distance and control, because he knew what the course was going to do, right? He knew if it was August and it was dry, it's going to bounce to the left. Like, all of this information rattled around in his brain, and he was taking everything was scientific in that point, right? I'm going to hit my 7-iron, 150. It's this natural fade to the right because this is how I want it to go. It's going to roll up. It's going to hit this hill. It's like, that's the genius of Ben Hogan here.
And he had a schematic, yes, for every golf course, and he,
yes,
had it planned out in his head, every shot that he was going to take on every hole. And he was confident enough that he didn't make a lot of bad shots.
I mean, barely any.
You know?
I mean, right? Like, I, yeah, mean, you look at Ben Hogan's life in golf, and it's about ball striking and doing it crisp, pure, clean. I mean, he wrote the book on how to be a better golfer, and it's a Bible to amateur golfers and professionals, probably. So Hogan, he thought that individual golf swings were, the quote, in the dirt, and that mastering required plenty of practice and repetition, which is what he was known for. He's also known spending years contemplating the golf swing, trying a range of theories and methods before arriving at the finishing method, which brought him his greatest period of success. So he's a tinkerer, right? I mean, he's just tinkering and tinkering and tinkering.
He's a perfectionist.
Well, and he has to, right? I mean, look at the ear early on in his career. He's battling a hook he's not understanding, or maybe he is, and he's trying to fix it. And the only thing that's working for him is to go back to the drawing board and practice new shots. You got to practice. You have to ingrain those shots, that understanding of the movement of the muscles, so you can keep hitting those shots correctly. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Like...
And he wasn't, you know, something else that's worth noting is he wasn't a big guy. He was 5'8" and weighed about 145 pounds, so... He's not maybe quite as small as Gene Sarison, but he's pretty close. That being said, he was a long ball hitter off of the tee, especially early on in his career.
Oh, yeah.
He hit the ball a long way, and
we've talked
a lot about his striking, but like many of the golfers of his day, he competed in long drive contests as well as match play and stroke play events. And we mentioned, you know, he liked shooting a number, so he didn't necessarily like match play and stroke play events, but we don't want to make him sound like a curmudgeon either.
He
loved playing golf, and he loved the game, and he loved, you know, all the different aspects of it. His mind was more lended towards the introvert side.
Yes, and so for his balls, the funny thing is I was just going over the notes, and I guess I missed this one, but... It says before his accident, he used to use a stronger grip style. So if you know what that means, the right hand's a little bit over the left. Prior to that, despite often practicing a weak grip, he was I just lost it. Right here. He was. It's what happens if you're having a weak grip that he hooked it a lot, and he had to like kind of turn that around. It's interesting that he said that Byron Nelson basically helped him develop a stronger grip when he was a kid, so he'd be able to hit the ball farther and stronger than his other contemporaries. But it also gave him this weird snap hook, which, not to out Chad here, but when we first started playing golf, Chad had a really strong grip, and at some points, strangely enough, he'd have this really hard hook to your right that I never really saw before. It's interesting to read that and then kind of see how he fixed it. I mean, like,
yeah. And they even had a nickname for his swing, it kind of in its finalized state, and they call it the Hogan Fade. And it's lower than usual for a great player, and from left to right. So it wasn't a towering shot, but it was more of a line drive. And the ball flight was a result of using a draw type of swing in conjunction with a weak grip. And that combination negated the chance of hitting a hook. So after tinkering and hitting tens of thousands of shots.
Oh, yeah.
He finally figured it out.
So, yeah, that wonderful Hogan fade that your golf instructor taught you, literally, you're welcome. That was from him. You know, that was how that worked. So he practiced with bare hands only. And then Tiger Woods is quoted in here saying he's one of the only players that he knows who owned their swing, that, you know, that they had total control of it and the resulting ball flight. So you got Tiger Woods, who's probably... I mean, definitely in our generation, the greatest golfer we've ever seen, and could be if he could pass Nicholas, the greatest golfer ever. I mean, he really could be. He's got lots of time left, but he's saying Ben Hogan's swing is all of his own, right? Ben Hogan knew at every moment what each muscle's doing, what each, you know, how to make these shots perfect. And then so there's something where he's getting pictures taken, right? Or something like that, right?
So there's a guy in 1967 who wrote the book The Golf Swing in 1974. And he, in 1967, he watched every shot that Hogan took at the Colonial National Invitational, which was in Fort Worth, where his hometown was. At this point, Hogan was 54 years old. Hogan shot a 281, for a third place tie with a guy named George Archer. And Kerry Middlecoff, the guy who wrote the golf swing book, he broke down all the shots and categorized them into 141 of the 281 were taken reaching the greens. And of the 141, 139 were rated from well executed to superbly executed.
Oh, Jesus.
Which means okay. There were two miss hits in there. Two miss hits out of 141. The remaining two were a drive that missed the fairway by 5 yards and a 5-iron to a par 3 that missed the green by about the same distance. It was difficult, and then he's later quoted, it was difficult, if not impossible, to conceive of anybody hitting the ball better over a 4-day span.
That's just crazy. Like, that's come gold. On, man. Yeah, that's, so, so what he wrote was, so he comes out with a book, and I believe it's called The Five Lessons, and there's the grip and all that fun stuff. Well, we find out that he was born left-handed, and he practiced... I believe he practiced doing things right-handed, though. I mean, which makes sense. Sorry, you know, left hands didn't have left-handed clubs when he was coming out.
Yeah. And it was looked at as a weakness and all sorts of weird stuff. Yeah. So,
but then he's done some interviews over the years where he's practiced with left-handed clubs, or with a left-handed club that had given to him because, you know, that's what happened. And that's what was happening when he went back to the right-handed. He was prone to hook it because he got somewhat used to using that left-handed club. There's a very kind of one of his biggest things was this 1-iron shot to the green on the 72nd hole in 1950 U.S. Open. So this is the first one that he wins after. The accident. He comes back that year. He wins this one. But it's one of the, if you can find it, and maybe I'll be able to throw it on Instagram or Twitter or something like that. But it's one of the photos. Everyone's seen it. He's using a 1-iron off the tee. Or I'm sorry, he's using a 1-iron off the fairway. And this photographer, Hi Peskin, gets this picture of him doing it, and it's a beautiful photo. It's one of the best photos I've ever seen. But he's just a great golfer. I mean, he just is a great golfer.
And that's the thing. Nicholas could play a 1-iron. Woods, I think he's dabbled with it, but I don't believe so. It's more of an older thing now that they have rescue or
hybrids
and rescue clubs now, but. A 1-iron's essentially lofted like a driver. I want to say it's about a 10-degree loft. And they're really hard to hit because there's not much spin, so the ball doesn't get very high. And Nicholas could hit a 1-iron. Hogan could hit a 1-iron. And there's maybe a handful of other people.
Yeah, I mean...
But it's one of the most difficult clubs to hit. And that's why you don't even hear about it.
No, you don't have... Yeah, you don't have that at all. So I don't know if Chad covered this part, but I hope he didn't. Some of his, he's widely considered the best golfer of his era. I mean, so eclipsing Byron Nelson, eclipsing Sam Snead. I would say eclipsing Gene a little bit. I mean, it gets kind of murky.
They were all great in their own right, and we're talking about a 30-year span. Obviously, some of these guys had great years. Other guys, you know, kind of faded a little bit. And that's just the story of golf. But through all the adversity that he had in his life, going to war, his wife and him in the bad car accident, you know, his father committing suicide when he was, you know, 9 years old.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff that really could have thrown his life off track, and he stayed focused on golf and was very successful.
So some of his nicknames were the Hawk or the Wee Iceman. That was the Scotland version because they you know, people are saying he possessed fierce determination and iron will. I mean, that's, we've talked to you for about 40 minutes now. Like, if you haven't figured out that Ben Hogan is tenacious and has the iron will. I imagine he got the Wee Iceman because he was a little bit more introverted, would be my thought, right? And he won.
Yeah.
And he was just there. He was the funny thing was, if you read other articles about him, it's almost as if he was a jerk. And it's, I think you have to look outside of that.
I think because a lot of people that we look at in the spotlight now, we expect people to be really friendly and bubbly and outgoing. And he just, that just wasn't his personality. No. He was more introverted, and that's okay.
Yeah, so he was rarely speaking.
Just oftentimes people want to pry and ask questions and all sorts of stuff like that, and some people just aren't really into that.
So he's like one of his, he's Hogan's sparse but pithy remarks. I read somewhere that it one of his quotes was, when he was a club pro, someone, wants help with their swing and all this fun jazz, and he basically tells the guy, like, hit 10,000 balls and then I'll give you one 10-minute lesson. And that was his approach to practice, right? I want to see you show me dedication and I'll give you some dedication, right? I mean, that's funny. I mean, it's not the nicest thing to say, but that was Ben Hogan's attitude. It's honest, right? Yeah. And
there's a few comments here. He was highly respected by his fellow competitors for his course management skills, which were top notch. He was like number one on course management.
Yeah.
And during his peak years, he rarely, if ever, took a shot in competition that he hadn't thoroughly honed in practice. So this wasn't a guy that was just, accidentally hitting balls into bunkers and stuff like that. It sounds like he made very, very few mistakes, and he just waited for other people to make mistakes.
Yeah.
And took advantage
exactly, of it. Exactly, yeah. And he just, I think that's exactly what, that's the best thing that about Ben Hogan, is that when we say he was shooting a number, it was that. It was, all right, your par or your course is 73. I'm going to shoot for 69 and 70, right? I'm going to hit those numbers. And that's going to be the best I can do. And if someone beats me, they beat me. So be it, right? But I'm going to be consistent, and I'm going to be grinding, and that's what I do.
So one of the things, we're getting towards the end of his career now at this point, before we wrap up, and they said, like a lot of pros, as they're aging, the putting starts to go. But him, this is one of the things that kind of hung around after the car accident was his one eye, his left eye, he was nearly blind in after that accident, and it really affected his depth perception.
Don't mean to laugh.
So it made his putting pretty poor by professional standards.
You can't see out of your left eye. I mean, what are we?
Yeah, exactly. His ball striking was still phenomenal.
Jeez.
But putting kind of was what slowed his career down there.
Man.
Going through the 50s and into the late 50s.
Oh my goodness. You've got to be kidding me.
So we're just going to go through some accolades.
Yeah,
we could go on for 20 minutes,
Go rapid fire exactly. Okay. Accolades and awards. So he played on two Ryder Cup teams, 1947, 1951. He captained them three times, 47, 49, and 67. Famously claiming on the last occasion to have brought the 12 best golfers in the world to play in the competition. And let's see, he won the two sides halves at 14 points, and Europe retained the cup on that one.
So Hogan won the Vardon Trophy, which is the lowest scoring average, three times. That was in 1940, 41, and 48. And in 1953, Hogan won the Hickok Belt as the Professional Athlete of the Year in the United States.
He also, 53, won the Associated Press Male Athlete of the Year and the PGA Player of the Year. So, 53 is a year that until Tiger Woods, right? Until 2000, until almost 50 years later, was never rivaled. I mean, never close to. Not a thing. Ben Hogan was given an award annually by the Golf Writers Association to golfer. Oh, it's a Ben Hogan Award. I'm sorry. Who, despite physical handicaps or serious illness, and the first winner was Babe Zaharas. Is that what I'm thinking?
Yeah, she's a famous female golfer.
Oh, okay. Really, okay. I like this. All
so
right.
the Ben Hogan Award is given by Friends of Golf and the Golf Coaches Association of America, and it's to the best college golf players. They started giving that award out in 1990.
He was inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1974. In 76, He was voted the Bob Jones Award, Bobby Jones, I imagine, the highest honor given to the United States Golf Association in recognition of distinguished sportsmanship in golf.
Hogan ranked 38th in ESPN's Sports Century 50 Greatest Athletes of the 20th Century. So
yeah, he's ranked in 2000 as the second greatest player of all, of Golf Magazine. Jack Nicklaus was first. Sam Snead was third. I mean, when Chad started this podcast or this episode saying he's a heavy hitter, it can go on and on and on. I mean,
Yeah. 2009, Hogan was ranked the fourth greatest golfer of all time by Golf Magazine. So obviously this is somewhat subjective, but he's up in the top two, three, four.
Ever. So he's the kind of the last little fun little tidbit. And I didn't actually know a lot about this. I didn't, besides his books, I didn't know what he was, I didn't know, right? I've never seen Hogan clubs. Have you? Have you ever seen, like...
I've seen them before, like in clubs? Goodwill.
Okay, yeah, I was like that. I've never seen them.
They're always old, and, they're pretty patinaed, kind of getting eaten away and stuff, but...
So he, in 1953, he has this, obviously, this... breathtaking year. He starts a golf club company in the fall of in Fort Worth, so basically where he's from, and he's doing clubs for the better player. Love that's what they call it, because is that for professionals, or is that what's that for? In 1960, he sells the company to American Machine and Foundry, AMF, but stays on as chairman of the board for several years. They're sold from 1960 to 85. I mean, like, that's legit, man. That's 25 years. I mean, that's pretty cool. So, and it's just an interesting thing. Callaway owns it now, I think. Is that right?
Up until, yes. Callaway owned it. They bought it in 2003. And Hogan line was discontinued in 2008.
Got you.
Yeah, it came up. There was like five sales and purchases there. It got bought in 1997 by Spalding Top Flight, which we all know, kind of sells some lower end golf gear.
But an actual it sold in 84 for $15 million, then sold in 88 for $55 million. Like that's legit, man. Yeah. That's a company that he built, he built because he wanted to do golf clubs.
So we'll just do a little recap here. We went over it already, but Hogan ended up winning the Masters twice, the U.S. Open four times, the Open Championship once, and the PGA Championship twice. He was inducted in the World Golf Hall of Fame in 1974. He won three Varden trophies. Just a all-around, it was somebody we had to cover if we're going to call this podcast the Golf Legends podcast.
Yeah, it was, and I might caveat this episode in the beginning. We're almost an hour in of us just jabbering away about Ben Hogan. I might cut this into two. We'll see how we kind of do it.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, it Ben Hogan. Man, we didn't even cover his book. That's the comedy of Ben Hogan, right?
But anybody who's into golf, who's been around golf, who's studied golf, knows about Ben Hogan's book. It's kind of the gold standard.
It really is.
It's a short paperback, less than 100 pages, but it's got a lot of visuals.
So much knowledge.
It's great.
So much knowledge, yeah.
So Ben Hogan lived to be 84. He died in his home state and home city of Fort Worth, Texas in 1997.
Wow. I mean, so. another long age, man. I'm telling you, I say it every episode, you can start drinking with it.
Yeah.
Is golf. I mean, that's what it is. So there's Ben Hogan, the legend, the true professional perfectionist. Sometime curmudgeon-ish golfer.
Depending on how you interpret it.
Yeah. Depending on how you go through it. So thanks, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Subscribe if you haven't done so already.
Yeah,
if
we got love... We saw that we have the people in the UK listening to us. We love that.
Yeah.
The home of golf is where we want to go for sure. So... We thank you. Thank all the listeners. We'd love to hear from you. Just for God's sake, somebody send us an email.
Yeah.
It's golflegendspod. So you got to put that S on it. pod@gmail.com. And otherwise we're on Twitter and Instagram and all that fun stuff. I'll try and grab that photo of Ben Hogan and throw it on all the social media. But that was
thanks for joining us, awesome. Guys, and we'll sign off and we'll see you next time.
See you later.
If you enjoyed our show, please rate us on Apple iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram @GolfLegendPod. If you have ideas on who we should cover or just want to drop us a line, please do @GolfLegendsPod@gmail.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll be back on the links in a week.